WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. A journalist following candidates as they stump across the country has to have a strong constitution. In the last 24 hours, Jonathan Alter survived 16 takeoffs and landings as he covered Bill Clinton's final whirlwind swing through eight states. Jonathan Alter is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine, where he writes a weekly column on the media and politics. He's followed the Bush and the Clinton campaigns for the magazine and analyzed the press coverage of the issues and the candidates. The press was severely criticized for its coverage of the 88 presidential campaign, where sound bites and photo opportunities and attack ads defined the tone and the content of the race. We caught up with Jonathan Alter in Little Rock, where he is awaiting the election returns. Before talking about how the press did in this election, I wanted him to describe what this last day was like.
It was surreal. This was the final trip through 10 states before the election, and we pulled an all-nighter. In fact, we have buttons that testify to that. I think the highlight and the low light at the same time, because we were so exhausted, was probably at close to 3 o'clock this morning when we were in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there were about 7,000 people there to greet Clinton, and it was freezing cold. They had been there for a while, and it was a real testament to how determined the Democrats in that state are to turning it around. It's gone Republican, and we were really exhausted by that time. I think that was our eighth city of the day, which is 16 takeoffs and landings, to put it another way. A camaraderie develops, as it usually does on these kinds of things. Clinton was in very good humor, and he spent a lot of time working the crowds, which seemed more frenzied and adoring than ever.
Why do you think he decided to do this whirlwind 10-state tour in the final day of the campaign? What was he trying to prove?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is, we call them robo-candidates sometimes. he just loves to campaign, and if he's elected, I think he will continue to campaign, this time for his ideas and for his program. He loves to meet and hug people, and he's just one of those people who comes up. He's not a back-slapping politician. He's a hugging politician. And he draws strength when he's had no sleep at all for weeks on end, and when he can barely talk because of his hoarseness. He draws strength from just touching people and feeling their energy, especially when they've been waiting for him for a long time. So part of the explanation is that he enjoys it. The second part of the explanation is that he wants to go for the burn. He really wants to have a big win if he's going to govern effectively. In his mind, he wants a mandate. So he went to a lot of states that are marginal, like New Mexico and Texas. He made two stops in Texas, Bush's home state, and as well as battleground states like Ohio and Michigan.
Did you find people like to be hugged by Bill Clinton?
Well, he wasn't hugging them if they didn't want to hug him.
Any awkward moments there?
No. It's he moves down a rope line, and people reach out to him. And there's some politicians who have a natural feel for citizens, and there are others who are kind of awkward about it. I mean, you can't really imagine, say, Richard Nixon doing it very well. It really is Hubert Humphrey-esque, his love of the people and of the process. And when you see him meet these other politicians along the way, all of whom turn out to bask in his glow, these Democratic politicians, most of them he hugs, and they draw his aura. But he has this, he knows all their names. He never messes up in his introduction of the local politicians, even when some of those local politicians are in trouble, as one in Texas is, for lying about her resume. He didn't shrink from her at all. He introduced her and hugged her, and he hugs the men. It's just a kind of a love of politics which turns some people off, but which is very much a part of who he is. How much this has to do with what he would be like as president is what interests me more than sort of the aesthetics of campaigning, since that's just about to be history. I think that even though he likes to sort of downplay some of his Democratic Party connections, and he talks about brain-dead politics in both parties, this guy will be a real Democratic pal as president if he makes it. Somebody who is in a lot of touch with the state, local, and county leaders and will use those connections and that tie he has with them that he's built up, not just this year, but over many years, as a way of advancing his program. And so we'll see whether that kind of LBJ quality works for him or not.
There is a belief, whether you choose to believe it or not, that the press is more supportive of Clinton than they are of any of the other candidates. Do you think that's true?
Right now, I think, yeah, to be honest, I think that is true. That if you took a poll of reporters, you would find that most of them were probably going to vote for Clinton. Not out of any tremendous enthusiasm. Reporters are a very skeptical, cynical lot, and very inclined to find fault wherever they can with any of these candidates. And not because of any sort of ideological component, but because Clinton is a better story. A Clinton administration would be a better story for a lot of these reporters than another Bush administration would be. Now, the same thing was true when Jimmy Carter was running for re-election, why I think the coverage that year tilted toward Ronald Reagan. Reporters, journalists like change. Change equals news.
So
something new is by definition news. And so what happens is there's almost an institutional interest in something unusual and exciting happening.
Well, let me get you to talk in some detail about what you think the media learned from the 1988 campaign that they really brought to the 1992 campaign.
Well, I think there was an awful lot of soul-searching in the news business after 1988 because pretty much everybody realized that we'd done a rotten job covering it. And so certain improvements were made. The obsession with photo opportunities and sort of soundbite coverage abated, and there was much harder look at issues, and even in some cases, I know we tried to do this, at what you could call sort of analytical speculation about what these guys would be like as president, which is, after all, the basic question that doesn't get addressed that much. How would they govern? And that was completely ignored in 1988, and I think we got a better sense of some answers to that question this time. That was partly under pressure from the people. The public was showing in many, many ways early on this year that they just would not accept the same kind of campaign coverage that they got the last time. They wanted more public access. They wanted town meeting type shows, which they got. They wanted more direct access through sort of man-on-the-street interviews and focus groups, so that voters were heard from rather than just pundits, and I think they got quite a bit of that. If you look, there was an awful lot of man and woman on the street type interviewing this year. And they also demanded that the press recognize its own often malignant role in the process, and I think there's more of that now, too. There's more understanding of how we affect things.
When you were traveling with the Bush and then the Clinton campaigns, how would you say their people tried to manipulate you to get you to write the story they wanted?
It's very subtle most of the time. I think the most common way of doing that is when they try to get you to report something about the other guy. Like, why aren't you all looking into this or that? The Bush people saying, you know, why aren't you looking into this or that about Clinton? And the Clinton people saying, why aren't you looking into this or that about Bush? And it becomes not that they ever have anything, and not that they would ever want to be tagged with having leaked you something sleazy about their opponent, but they want you to do it and leave no fingerprints at the same time. So that's when you feel manipulated, is when you think that you're being asked to be a kind of an assassin for one side against the other.
How would you say fax machines change this campaign?
That's a very good question. It greatly shortened the cycle. So it used to be that somebody would make a charge and then it would be responded to in the afternoon or the next day, and there was a lot of lag time in communication. And now it's instantaneous, and so you have this rapid fire back and forth of competing faxes. The main political significance of it is that in 1988, Bush would make a charge, Dukakis wouldn't respond. The charge would sit out there, and as political consultants will tell you, if you don't respond to a charge, the public thinks it's true. So this time, the Clinton people went to great pains to respond very, very rapidly, within hours, sometimes minutes, of any charge launched by George Bush. The Bush people, on the other hand, used the fax machine as another means of trying to raise doubt about Bill Clinton, and they just loaded them with insults every day. They were jam-packed with insults. The Clintons were, too, because the hostilities escalated. So if you wanted to see the real vituperative character assassination, the place to look were the faxes.
Not on the networks.
Well, radio ads and faxes.
Yeah.
Radio ads are much take longer to respond to. It takes a little longer to figure out which markets they're in, and you can deliver a very negative message more easily on radio than television. So, for instance, the Clinton people have been complaining in the last couple of weeks that in Louisiana and Florida, Georgia, and some other places that the Bush people have been broadcasting lies about them. For instance, in Georgia, the Clinton people say that Bush was putting out an ad that said that Clinton would close all the bases in Georgia, when the Clinton people say that they intended no such thing. Now, one of the problems for the press is that if you want to wade into one of these disputes, you can't really rely on either side. You have to go out and do independent reporting. And frequently that doesn't get done. So you get this kind of charge, counter-charge form of journalism, which isn't really very enlightening, where one side says this, the other side says that. What I think the voters want from the press is to go out and find some approximation of which side is closer to the truth. And there was more of that this year, especially with television ads, which were pretty well scrutinized, particularly on CNN. There was more of that, but not enough.
Jonathan Alter is my guest, and he has a column on the media and politics in Newsweek magazine. He's been following the Clinton campaign. He's joining us from Little Rock, Arkansas, where he's camped out for Election Day. He survived Bill Clinton's whirlwind final tour in the last 24 hours. We're going to pick up where we left off after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, and he's a political reporter and columnist for Newsweek magazine. How would you say the candidates have been able to manipulate the press during this campaign?
Well, first of all, I think that the level of manipulation is way down from what it was in the past. And part of that is because the focus of the campaign has shifted from the evening news to this tremendous variety of outlets. And there's been a kind of a democratization of news, which is very positive. It used to be that the way to keep score and tell whether somebody had a good day or a bad day was exclusively on the basis of how successful they were at manipulating patriotic images or anti-crime images for the evening news. And now these guys have to go out and actually explain themselves. It's much harder to manipulate the symbols on Larry King or the Today Show than it is when you're not really talking to the press at all, just showing them photo opportunities.
But there have been stories that the press dropped everything to cover. Of course, Jennifer Flowers is one of them. The charges that Bush made, I believe it was on Larry King, about what Bill Clinton was doing in the Soviet Union. He started by saying, I don't have the facts, or I don't know the facts, but here's the story. And yet the press follows it.
Yeah, and that's a real serious problem. And it is a form of manipulation, because what ends up happening is, even if the story is untrue, it works its way up the media food chain, and it reverberates, makes a metaphor, you know, it goes from being a one-day story to being a five-day story.
Do you think there were enough investigative pieces that really got to particular issues, whether it was the sort of snoozer issues like the economy or the trade agreements, or even getting to who these candidates really are?
I think a lot of reporters aren't all that interested in the sort of substance of governing. So it's much easier to ask a question or many questions about the draft, for instance, than it would be about why it took Clinton so long to take a position on the North American Free Trade Agreement. The latter, even though it's more important in my mind, just kind of sounds duller and isn't the kind of question that gets shouted from a rope line at the candidate when he's moving by.
You have an article in this week's Newsweek about Ross Perot, and you say, really, give him something to fix. And that would be a very appropriate use of his talents.
Right. I think that Perot is going to be around whether the new president wants him or not. He's like a Jesse Jackson with $3 billion. He's going to be somebody to contend with. And so my sense is that what the new president should do is say, here's the post office, here's the General Services Administration, which manages all the buildings and possessions of the federal government. Fix it. And don't go on Larry King Live until you do. And I think at that point he would have to show some results, because his whole thrust is to stop talking about it and start doing it. And the problem is that Perot, there's so many examples of his associations in the past where he's been brought in to an institution, and very quickly it's turned ugly, and he's resigned with a blast at the chairman of GM or other things he's been involved with. And so I think that Clinton would certainly think twice about it, but I don't know if he'd be any better off with them outside. You know, there's that old Lyndon Johnson line that it's better to be inside the tent peeing out than outside the tent peeing in, and Ross Perot is, if he were in government, he would be inside the tent peeing in.
So a colorful description,
yeah,
if I ever heard
it really, I don't know if it'll really work. And, of course, if Bush were to somehow win, he would have nothing to do with Perot, since there's terribly bad blood there.
Well, let me ask you, since you have covered both the Bush and Clinton campaign and followed the candidates around, do you really learn something by being part of the press pack?
Not that much. And it's some news organizations have to have somebody there full time, the wire services, for instance. But for the rest of us, it's just silly to be out there too much. First of all, you miss a lot of the rest of the campaign, which is taking place on television, and you're in a cocoon on these campaigns where you're almost cut off from what's happening in the rest of the campaign. It's oftentimes the worst place to be, but you also just can't be a couch potato the whole time. You have to go out and and smell it sometimes, or you lose perspective. So what I've tried to do, and I think a lot of other reporters as well, is to kind of hop on and off the plane, go out for a couple of days, and then go back home again.
You described the fact that you, within the last 24 hours, took off and landed 16 times. Are you a anxious flyer?
I am sometimes, but there are a couple of reporters who are really anxious flyers, and they were teased a lot. Actually, I thought the more... nerve-wracking had with Hale Boggs in Texas. And he was an important congressional leader who flew off after Clinton drove him to the airport on a trip to Alaska from which he never returned in a famous aviation accident. His wife, Lindy Boggs, later went to Congress.
Right.
His daughter is Cokie Roberts.
Right.
He started telling this story associating with the mango ice cream he was eating, and it was a little bit chilling. Clinton has a sense of mortality that he's talked about sometimes in the past that comes from having lost his father before he was born. And although he wasn't talking in any kind of explicit way about that, I think a few of the reporters afterwards were saying, is this one of those occasions where the mango ice cream will cause us all to go down in flames? And, of course, if that happened, none of these big-name reporters would be in the lead of the obituary.
Well, you use the word surreal to describe your last 24 hours. That might sum it up. Do you have post-election blues?
I'm not quite sure how I'll feel this time. I mean, I have been completely immersed in this, and most of the time immersed in it in a way that I loved, the way you can get immersed in sports or, you know, or music or anything else. And I guess I will suffer some withdrawal pains, but it is awfully exhausting. And I think just about everybody involved in the process is ready for this thing to be over.
And you're looking forward to a good night's sleep then?
Hope so.
Well, Jonathan Alter, thank you for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Thanks.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks.
Jonathan Alter is a senior editor at Newsweek, where he writes a weekly column on the media and politics. He spoke to us from Little Rock. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.